We're talking with Glenn Kimball about his expertise, his lens on ancient manuscripts and what it tells us about this big story this week about the revelation that, in fact, there are existing photographic copies of an alternate Quranic text. We'll get into that coming up in just a second and what the implications are for academia, how hard it will be for this to be studied openly, according to critics, and I'll read you an interesting piece written about that, too, in just a minute. Great stories, by the way, on the website. If you go to coasttocoastam.com, you'll look for the link to the story about that UFO sighting in Turkey and watch that video. I think that that is got to be a separate upcoming Coast to Coast story. Seems like right now, Texas, Turkey, a couple other places in Europe, these sightings are coming with many more video and photographic evidence. What a difference it makes. And where would we be with this Quranic discussion if somebody hadn't had a microfilm and then not destroyed it? And we'll talk about that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So I thought it was interesting. We were talking about these Nazi Arabic scholars that had a copy of this alternate Quranic text and had been guarding it so that it couldn't be examined, so that you couldn't read it as a university scholar, as an academic, and look for variations in the text. You couldn't look for more versions of words that may have been misinterpreted over time, or other scribal errors which may have caused ripples within the within Islamic theology, because it was such a threat to the alliance between Islam and, at the time, Adolf Hitler's Germany. And I thought what was really interesting, Glenn, was that even after World War II, a lot of these original Nazi scholars remained in high academic positions throughout Germany, and they were still, seemingly because of this a shared belief and anti-Semitism, they were still withholding what they knew or availability to these documents well into the 1970s.
Well, that's certainly true. We have to remember that even though the publicly Hitler may have said that he ordered the destruction of these documents, what he said in public and what he did in private were two very different things. He would never have destroyed anything this precious that came into his possession. Hitler was, he had an enormous collection of things that he had taken from around the world that were kept in salt mines in Germany that still haven't been all returned.
Right. Well, I want to read a little bit more from this article. I found this one at a website, at an Assyrian news website, and this is how they phrased it. Why were the Nazis so eager to suppress Quranic criticism? Most likely, and we talked about the anti-Semitism thing, but it goes on to say that the one author makes a bold and consequential statement about this, and that is, and I just lost my place, the dissemination of European models of anti-Semitism among Muslims was not haphazard, but an actual project of the Nazi Party to create more anti-Semitism, essentially, amongst Muslims, meant to turn Muslims against Jews and Zionism. He says that in the years before World War II, two Muslim leaders in particular willingly and knowingly carried Nazi ideology directly to the Muslim masses, and he has their name here. They were people who were founders of the Muslim Brotherhood. And I'll go on to read. It may be a very long time before the contents of any of these archives are known. Some Quranic critics, notably the pseudonymous scholar Ibn Marak, claim that Professor Angelica Newworth, the archives custodian, has denied access to scholars who stray from traditional interpretation. So you have to agree to interpret it the correct way before they'll even let you look at it. And I think this is, again, this speaks to what's going to happen if, as we know this week, this is no longer, it's a cat that gets out of the bag, and there won't be one scholar or a group of scholars that have access to this this other Quranic text, but it'll be out for the world to see.
Well, the thing that amazes me is that this isn't the first time that there have been evidence that there were variations in the Quran. Scholars have been saying this for decades. The fact that this is some sort of a news story is semi-preposterous because they have been studying the variations and the various Quranic finds in China and in Russia and other places for decades and decades. The fact that this particular one was kept by the Nazis, I think, has really brought it to the forefront of the paparazzi, so to speak.
Well, I'm not sure you get that. I mean, you may be right, but I look at what some of the claims made by alternative Quranic scholars, and what they're saying is we don't know what's in it yet. We don't know how different the texts are yet because they've been so secretive about them.
And these particular texts, you're right.
Yeah, and I think that's the part.
That these aren't unique in being different. There are other versions.
Right, but they may be so different. And the separation, now we don't know that. They could end up not being that way. But it seems the amount of effort that's been put forth by generations of Nazi-sympathizing scholars in Germany would seem to indicate that there's something explosive about it, that if there wasn't, why wouldn't they just have let it out, you know, decades ago?
Well, and I must respectfully disagree a little bit on this.
Go ahead.
Not 180 degrees against that particular position. But we really live in the day of the Islamic Inquisition. We've already gone through a Christian Inquisition.
Right.
Some centuries ago. Where anybody that differed from the Catholic or the universal definition of the Bible was considered a heretic and worthy of being burned at the stake, and the Templars were exterminated for all intents and purposes as an entity in 1307 because they had in their possession a library in Great Britain that was very different than that of the Vatican.
Sure.
Feel larger than that of the Vatican, and in fact, it was so much larger that the largest library of Jesus that still exists in our world today still is in Great Britain and is not in the Vatican.
Right.
I spoke with the head of the British Israel Society, their representatives from Great Britain, as early as today. And they told me about the hundreds and hundreds of volumes that they're going to be publishing in this coming year that'll be on my website. But this is a site where there were huge libraries, enormous libraries. And the reason why there was an enormous library was because after the death of Jesus, when Joseph of Arimathea took the famous personalities for their own protection into self-imposed exile into Great Britain, they were given the 12 hides of Glastonbury, which is roughly 2,000 acres. This became a sovereign nation for 1,000 years. They didn't pay taxes to the British crown until Henry II.
Right.
And following Henry II, Edward I took over, and Edward I was Longshanks from Braveheart fame.
Sure.
And carried out this extermination order of the Templars. And they had to go underground and change their name, and many of them... Much of what they believed and many of their texts went into Scotland and became integrated with Freemasonry and other movements. And so we know what they had. I think it's kind of interesting to know, we get back to this Da Vinci Code thing for a moment. Henry Lincoln made an interesting comment. He was, if you know who Henry Lincoln was.
Sure, he's one of the co-authors of the Holy Blood, Holy Grail.
Right, and that Holy Blood, Holy Grail was, for all intents and purposes, one of the foundations of Dan Brown's book,
sure,
called The Da Vinci Code. But he made an amazing statement that was aired on the television here in my area last week. He said there were really two secrets of the Da Vinci Code. One was the Rennes-le-Château comments that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene, which was, by the way, an old story because we have Sanhedrin documents which talk about Jesus's courtship of the Mary Magdalene that come from 2,000 years ago that are very much from the Vatican and the Hagia Sophia shared in common.
Right.
But the fact remains is that Joseph went there and he began a school, and the school began collecting manuscripts. They already had some manuscripts in Great Britain at that time.
You mean Joseph of Arimathea goes there?
He goes there and he starts a school.
Right.
And whenever you see school, that means they collected manuscripts. And they already had the old Lamfadla documents, which were the documents where Jeremiah had visited Great Britain with Tetethi in tow, which was the daughter of Zedekiah, who escaped the Babylonian conquest. That's why Jesus' grandmother, the great Saint Anna, really came from Britannia and not necessarily was born in Jerusalem or thereabouts.
Well, but even what you're saying right there, as that may not be agreed upon by all Christians or people of, or for that matter, historians, they may not agree with that, but you can have that discussion and I can have that discussion. And that is the essential difference that what you're talking about there is what the church would refer to as either a heresy or a heterodoxy. You're talking about an alternate version, another version of
well,
the
we have
of the story.
Manuscripts to that effect.
Oh, I'm with you. But my point is that that's so interesting because we compare that to the case here of this Quranic document,
exactly.
which is just resurfaced, and there is no allowed alternate version. In fact, you know, even in this, in discussing this one particular version of the Quran, which they have on microfilm, which just resurfaced this week, scholars who wondered about what was on it would get fired. You know, people that had tried to get access to it could get fired from their academic positions. That's how explosive this is.
Well, it is enormously explosive because of jihad. I mean, how would you like to be a school and be under the threat of your Islamic community coming in and bombing your campus?
Well,
which is a real possibility.
Or having even in the West, and this is the point that a couple of the articles have made about this, the Wall Street Journal doing a piece we referenced to earlier, where these Arabic studies departments or, you know, various, you know, combinations where you're doing Middle Eastern studies or Quranic studies, they're all funded by the Middle East. And anybody that attempts to deviate from an orthodoxy, even at the academic level on public universities, can risk losing their funding. So, I mean, there's a lot of control that's going on about this that seems to be intended to support one particular religious view, and that is, you know, the luxury of maintaining that there is no version other than the Quran, the popular version of the Quran that is authorized by God.
And you know what amazes me, and when you say that, I hear you saying that, it makes me question the courage of our scholastic community.
Yeah. Okay.
how courageous are they to reshape history based on being threatened physically, and that it's really possible that that could occur, and yet it's a reality. It's a reality in our day. We are still running from this. You cannot do it in America. You can't go to Harvard University and say we're going to start this study and get funded or get the approval of the administrators or the dean of the department because they don't want to have the Arabic community raise up and cause a problem on campus.
Well, this speaks to another story, and it's pardon everybody for the sidebar, but I thought it was very interesting that one California university had been proposing that all of their staff, all their faculty and staff, sign a pledge which was one that would hold them to a non-judgmental position on beliefs. That is to say that not any one belief on campus could be promoted above any other. And the pushback that came from the faculty was, well, then this means that fascism or racism or sexism deserves as much time on the campus as any of these other belief systems. And the school says, well, we don't mean that. But I mean, it just goes to show you that there is, it seems like there's some sort of scholastic cowardice that goes on at the university level in many cases, private and public, because there is a philosophy or a theology from the top of the university that they're trying to get the rest of the school to maintain for them. And that may not, it may be absolutely inaccurate, or it may be, you know, that the beliefs of the university at the top are protecting something and the rest of the faculty is going to have to go along with it or leave.
That's absolutely correct. And there are other examples we can give of that very same phenomena. Under John Wesley Powell, who was commissioned by the United States government to go out and put together American history, for example, he took teams of archaeologists all the way from the Mississippi Valley all the way to the eastern coast of the Rockies, getting artifacts out of these mounds that were built. He got 12,500 of them, all of which he summarily destroyed on purpose to keep us from having to deviate from our customary versions of how America was discovered. It's amazing that this is an old story where right. We have been pushed and shoved into what we commonly believe is history, and there comes a point where academia becomes afraid, lacks the courage to discuss the truth.
But it cuts both ways, and I'll wrap up this thought on this. That the a couple of people have made the point that the Vatican was in dialogue with Islam, and there was to be a dialogue, a proposal to have a conference with all the Western religions, and this was supposed to include Islamic scholars and everything, and it was supposed to be, you know, kind of a symposium looking for common ground, a way of building toward a future. But it broke down on the subject of textual criticism, because the demand on the part of the Muslim scholars was that they got to maintain this belief that the Quran was the pure dictation of God, and that there could be no textual criticism of the Quran in this conversation. They could criticize the Bible, the Holy Bible, or any other religious text, but no other proponents of their religious text could criticize the Quran. And that's why it broke down. Now, I think that has implications to exactly to this story and how sensitive people are going to be if, in fact, they find more differences in this rediscovery of this older Quranic text.
Without any question. And that exceeds the boundary of just religious documents. This persecution of by academia, they felt this perceived threat on their part for massive change has been around since the beginning of the Americas, since the beginning of the Revolutionary War and before.
All right. Now, before is where I want to get to. We have a little time left before we get to the phones, and I want you, Glenn Kimball, can you in a half hour tell me the story of King Arthur's brother coming to Mobile, Alabama?
Well, Arthur...
Can you do it next? Can you hang up? Will you
sure.
do it?
Sure.
Okay. If you don't, I'll be scratching my head for the rest of this week wondering about it, and I have too much to do. So you've got to take me out of my misery. Got to hear the story. Glenn Kimball will tell it next, of how King Arthur's brother ends up in Mobile, Alabama. And then we'll get to your calls for Glenn Kimball in our last hour on Coast to Coast AM. All right, so it started as a digression in our previous conversation, Glenn Kimball talking about the 7th century and what was going on when Muhammad was developing Islam. So one thing led to another. Next thing you know, I'm hearing Glenn just gonna toss off, as Glenn does, gonna toss off this fact that King Arthur's brother was in Mobile, Alabama. And I'm dying to know, how do we know that? And I know that Glenn will have a fascinating answer. We'll do that before we get to your calls for Glenn Kimball coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So let's get to it then. The story of how King Arthur's brother could end up becoming the starting quarterback for the Crimson Tide. Exactly how did this happen? Exactly.
Well, let's look at the evidence first of all, okay? If you go to Great Britain, you go to the Stoke Dry Cathedral right there near Wales, near Glastonbury. They have a fresco on the wall that still remains to this very day. It has the depictions of King Arthur II, or some say it was Madoc, who was killed by Native American Indians. It has him actually being filled with arrows and the pictures of the Native American Indians. And people have questioned that for a long period of time until they began to get into the actual documents, the property documents, which are called the Landau Charters. And by the way, my copy of that cost me a pretty penny. It really hurt my pocketbook.
Stop. Let me, what do you mean by that? How much would it cost you to get a copy of something like that?
It cost me $250.
Okay. Now,
these were like the county recorder documents at the time of King Arthur.
Okay.
That tell about who actually existed. There have been scholars and historians who've dismissed King Arthur as being a myth. Unfortunately, they have the property records of himself and Madoc, his brother, actually owning property. So he was not a myth at all. He was very, very real. When King Arthur was alive, he stood on Mount Tor, which was nothing but a labyrinth that looks much like the Mayan labyrinths today.
Right.
He said that his treasure was in Avalon. And Avalon was beneath the constellation of the Americas, the America constellation, star constellation, which was in the west. And his brother had already gone to the west, the land of the apples, and part of the reason why New York is called the city of the apples, you know, the Big Apple.
The Apple.
But he came here and he settled here. As a matter of fact, Lewis and Clark, when they were commissioned to go and investigate all the way to the West Coast,
right,
they were given a Welsh translator intentionally so that they could speak with the Native American Indian tribes that only spoke Welsh.
Okay. A, I've never heard that. Fascinating. B, I want to go back to the images of Madoc being attacked by Native Americans?
Native American Indians.
Okay. What did they do to him? They shot him full of arrows?
Yep, killed him.
Okay.
And he left artifacts here, by the way. Adrian Gilbert's book on the Holy Kingdom. You know who Adrian Gilbert is?
I do. He's the guy who does the stuff on the don't tell me stop on the Magi.
On the Magi, he also did the book of the Holy Kingdom with Wilson and Blackett, who are the foremost scholars on King Arthur in the world.
Okay.
They have discovered the tomb of the original King Arthur there in Glastonbury. Their book on Arturo Rex, I've still got out-of-print copies on my website. It's the only place you can get them in the world. It's amazing what they have done, but Adrian Gilbert wrote the book for them because they weren't the writers that Adrian Gilbert was. But in his book, right on the cover, the paperback or the hardback version of the cover was a sword, a Welsh sword that was found in Pennsylvania from the 7th century AD. Now, how did that get there? And it was called the Sword of King Arthur. It wasn't the sword of King Arthur. It was the sword of his brother Madoc, who was here.
Right.
So we actually have artifacts that survive in the Americas from the time of King Arthur. And why did he come here? Well, he came here for a number of different reasons, not the least of which was this was the treasure house where gold was available. They could trade with the native populations for precious metals. But this was always the place for the transport of metals to the Far East and to the Middle East and to Europe. We know that back as far as the time of Hatshepsut in Egypt, the Phoenicians were importing copper during the Bronze Age for the building of the pyramids and afterwards. And where did they get all this copper? Certainly the copper mines in Egypt and the ones in Spain didn't come close to producing enough copper for the Bronze Age. Just the bronze alone that would have been required for the chisels to carve the pyramids would have exceeded the output of their mines there by tenfold. So where were they getting their copper from? Well, we know from reliefs on the walls at Luxor and places in Egypt that they were getting these skin ingots of copper from the Phoenicians, and the Phoenicians were getting them from Michigan. The copper mines in Michigan, as far
they were
back
coming,
as 1800 years B.C.
So the Phoenicians were going to, what, taking the St. Lawrence Seaway?
They were coming up the Mississippi and going through the St. Lawrence Seaway. They were going both directions. That's why when Christopher Columbus came on the scene, he really had two objectives. He wanted to get a passageway to Cathay, but he also wanted to stop off. He had a map, by the way. Isn't it nice that Christopher Columbus had a map?
Yeah.
And in the middle of the map is the a map of the Americas. I kind of figured that was kind of hilarious. But his second purpose in his own diaries was that he wanted to go to the land of the Garden of Eden.
Right. I've heard that. I thought that's always very interesting. But I'm stuck. I don't know. You can't get to Michigan from the Mississippi, can you? I mean,
overland you can.
Overland. But I just mean you can't get there just using the Mississippi. But going down the St. Lawrence Seaway, I could see how they would do that.
Which is even closer.
But how did they know that it was there, that the copper was there to be mined to take back to sell to the Egyptians?
Because the copper, the trade between East and West had already been long ago. We know that. We know that the original mummies from 2,500 years B.C. in Egypt, the nine sarcophaguses kept in Germany. Once again, we go back to this German confiscation of artifacts.
Right.
All nine of those mummies were tested to find out what kind of elements that they were eating, and every one of them had cocaine in their hair, and they were mummified with tobacco in their stomachs. Now, cocaine's only grown in one place in the world, and that's in the Andes Mountains. And tobacco's only grown in the Americas. And that fact is real. I mean, the toxicology reports are real scientific evidence that trade was going on between East and West.
Interesting. So how did they know that he was killed, that Madoc, King Arthur's brother, was killed by Native Americans?
Because his body was brought back and buried and interred. And it's a subject of enormous numbers of paintings and reliefs in Great Britain.
So it was just Madoc himself that was killed, not all of his investigating party or
anything like
that?
Absolutely not all of them, because they survived and integrated with the Native American Indian tribes, which learned to speak Welsh.
And that's why Lewis and Clark brought with them a Welsh interpreter.
Exactly. They were assigned a Welsh interpreter.
Okay. I am completely intrigued by this. Every time I talk to you, I learn something new. Now, can we get an update from you before we go to the phones coming up? Because I know someone will ask if I don't. On the last time you and I talked, we were talking about documents that you had seen but were not yet available to you coming up from the Yucatan. Do you want to talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, we're waiting to get permission for them to actually deposit them with us. I don't know whether they ever will. My MO is that if you're not willing to hand me the documents, I'm not certainly going to go to war to try and get a copy of them. I've always been had an open dialogue with people and say, hey, look, if you'd like to publish your documents, I'd be glad to help you with that. The majority of the people who have documents don't leave them with me, but I have enough that do leave them with me that it... I'm never going to be done in my lifetime with the manuscripts that I already have available to me that talk about history that has been eliminated from our schools and our history departments and universities.
Sure. One of those was this belief that there were giants in the Yucatan in the jungles, and that it was well known that there was going to be a photograph or a revelation that they were willing to make about these underground societies that exist in Mexico, right?
Yeah, actually, one of their messengers came right here to Arizona, and my son interviewed him. I wasn't here at the time. My son interviewed him. He was a representative of the six Mayan tribes that still exist in the Yucatan Peninsula. People say that the Mayans are extinct from the time of the Aztecs. They're really not extinct at all. They just went underground. They live in the ruins in the Yucatan Peninsula and into Central America. And there's also tribal groups that live in the ruins in Bolivia, Chile, and Peru. You know, Red Elk is not wrong when he talks about the long walkers living in caves. I'm not sure that these were the caves, but they certainly were tunnels where people try and stay out of the view of ESPN or out of MSNBC.
They don't want to get recruited to play basketball. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, and you know, I took pictures of myself alongside two of the giant mummies when I was in Lima, Peru. These two mummies were 9.5 feet tall. They had their golden crowns, which would have gone around my waist. Of course, I was a lot thinner then. It wouldn't have gone around my waist. Maybe around my hand now. You know.
Right. Right.
But their cloak, their woven golden cloak or cape that they had, was 14 feet high. Their gloves had fingers that were 10 inches, golden gloves, solid gold gloves. They were woven gold, so you could move them. But they were 10 inches long. I took pictures alongside these giant guys, their mummies. So the fact that there were giants that existed in Central and South America is not enough for me. In fact, those museums are still open to the public today. You can go down and take pictures today if you want to.
I was just doing a little Googling while you'd mentioned that before, and so I was just kind of seeing whether there was other people out there that had made this connection on Lewis and Clark. And very interestingly, again, Glenn, always fun to talk to you, they referred to them as the Welsh tribes.
Right.
And they were looking for that at some point they thought Lewis and Clark might make a connection with the Welsh tribes, but they have them listed as being in California, or at least the one place I went to said that they were in California.
That's one of the places that they were located.
Okay.
There were Welsh tribes all across the Mississippi Valley, all the way west into California.
Okay.
And these Welsh-speaking tribes were not just isolated to California. I mean, and pardon me for this reference, but the proverbial Mormon pioneers had Welsh translators when they crossed from Illinois into Utah.
Right.
They had Welsh translators and spoke to some of these surviving Welsh Native American Indians. So, when you're talking about the influence of the Welsh in America, it's certainly way, way pre-Columbian.
Yeah, it sure is. I'm curious, too, about were there other records, Indian records, surviving that talk about the Welsh coming or King Arthur's brother? I mean, is there a corresponding version? Because that would have been a very early Western European exploration, right? I mean, if not the very first, it would have been amongst the first.
Well, the Native American Indians that we know today weren't largely writers. There are some pictorial,
yeah, that's what I'm talking about,
type things that are
right,
rather amazing. One of the petroglyphs that I saw was a Native American Indian tribe carrying what looked to me, for all intents and purposes, like the Ark of the Covenant, carrying it through the into battle with them, with the cherubim on the surface of it, and it was absolutely amazing to me.
Well, doesn't that go to the story that the Ark of the Covenant is in Arkansas? I mean, isn't that something you told me once?
Yep, it sure is.
Okay, and that's why we call it Arkansas. And that the ark was brought there for safekeeping by whom?
Well, the ark was brought here by Jeremiah. Jeremiah, or the Odlam Fadla documents, by the way, you can find Irish Prince Hebrew Prophet on my website, which is the documented evidence of what happened to Jeremiah. Jeremiah took the daughter of King Zedekiah for her own safety. You know, Zedekiah and his sons were all murdered at the time of the Babylonian conquest. He took them out of there. He, you know, Jeremiah was the one who stood on the wall and said, "Repent or we're all going to be destroyed." Ezekiel and Daniel all prophesied about that. Well, that happened. And he took the remnants to Great Britain for their safety. And that information is still in Great Britain. And the documents that survive in Great Britain are in this book, Irish Prince Hebrew Prophet. Which is amazing.
No. And what other, before we get to the phones, let me ask you, what other things are coming across your desk these days that you're looking forward to being able to publish on your website?
Well, I'm just delighted to have the traditions of the early life of Abraham, which is the next things I'm going to be doing, all the writings about Abraham. Abraham is the connecting force, obviously, between all of the five major religions in the world. If you go back in the Old Testament, remember Hebrew means the descendants of the prophet Eber. Hebrew, Eber. He was alive just after the flood of Noah, and he had two sons. One was Peleg from the Tower of Babel, and he became the patriarch of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But he had another son who was named Joktan. This is biblical. You can look it up in the Bible. Joktan went east to the larger populations of the world, which was China. And so the Abrahamic traditions were well accepted in China, whether we think our version of China today is via communism, not via what was really in existence in China. But Abraham is the guy who brought them all together, because remember that Brahma was the source for both Hinduism and for Buddhism. Brahma, who was Brahma? Well, Brahma had a wife whose name was Sarah, and Abraham was Brahma. And we have the text from very, very, very ancient scholars that talk about the early life of Abraham, and I think that this will be a way for us to amalgamate or to extend hands across religious traditions, all the way from Islam to Buddhism to Christianity and Judaism, and understand that we all had a common source we've deviated. We all like to think we own history. We like to vindicate our own traditions, our own cultures, our own race, our own people, our own politics. But the reality is that we shared many of the traditions in common.
Well, it'll be very interesting to see where we go when we get to the phone calls coming up in just a few minutes. As always with Glenn Kimball, you can ask about any of his work, and I know that there may be an update or two that I'm missing. I've asked for all the ones that came to mind with me, but I'm sure somebody will ask you about a past show. And then I'd love to get more questions, if I could, about this new Quranic text. I say newly available, thought once destroyed by the Nazis or Nazi-sympathizing academics in Germany after the war, but in fact was not destroyed. And a new version of this old text has become available, and scholars will begin to pore over it as it gets universal access for the first time ever. And we'll find out whether or not there are other disparities in other versions of the Quran, what that means to mainstream Islam, which maintains that the word of Islam in the Quran is the uncorrupted testimony, the recitation of the angel to Muhammad himself, and we'll have all sorts of different ways this last hour will go with Glenn Kimball next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.